This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to preview the upcoming Lionfish Challenge. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Incentive Program encourages anglers and divers to remove as many of the invasive fish from the water as they can. Plus, we're going to chat with a Florida Gulf Coast University entomologist about love bugs after the recent bountiful season. But first, the newly announced Blue-Green Algae Task Force.
Well, thank you, Adrian, and that's great to be here. You know, this place with a very special namesake, Nat Reed. It's great to see the rest of the family here. You guys, you know, have been great. And it's great to be here to make another announcement. I mean, as you know, we've charged hard to say that water resources and Everglades are going to be a priority for my administration. We've unveiled a number of actions already, including the Water Management District, including the budget requests, which we're doing very well with in the legislature right now. One of the things that we promised we would do in that executive order is constitute a blue-green algae task force. As people in this area know too well, you know, that toxic algae has been a massive problem. It's been a problem on the southwest coast of Florida as well. Very well may have been the contributor to why the red tide was so bad. So this is something that as we're getting resources, financial resources to bear on the problem and making good choices, you know, we want to make sure those choices are informed by the best science and the best research available. So we are going to be announcing today five expert researchers and leading scientists to serve on our blue-green algae task force.
That was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis announcing the formation of a new blue-green algae task force on April 29th at the Nathaniel P. Reed Hobie Sound National Wildlife Refuge. The task force is comprised of five researchers, Dr. Wendy Graham from the University of Florida, Dr. Evelyn Gazer from Florida International University, Dr. James Sullivan from Florida Atlantic University, Dr. Valerie Paul from the Smithsonian Marine Station at Fort Pierce, and last but not least, our guest today, Dr. Mike Parsons from Florida Gulf Coast University. Dr. Parsons, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Julie. It's great to be here.
It's great to see you again. And as always, we invite you to join our conversations. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Parsons, congratulations on your appointment to the State Task Force on Blue-Green Algae.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Pretty impressive. So this task force is supposed to do what exactly?
Basically, what we're looking at are both short-term and long-term solutions to the blue-green algal bloom problems. And so when we're looking at short-term solutions, it's basically addressing blooms that are potentially going to happen again in the future. We hope not, but we need to be prepared for these blooms and basically mitigating the impacts, lessening the impacts of these blooms. On a longer-term scale, we're looking at trying to prevent the blooms themselves, which really comes down to nutrient reduction measures. So kind of revisiting water quality rules, statutes, numerical criteria, so on and so forth, looking at ways that we can improve our water quality and lower nutrient inputs to our system.
So it's completely focused on blue-green algae?
Yes.
Not red tide?
Not red tide. There's a separate task force for red tide. It was formed many, many, many years ago. It's been inactive for probably about the past 5 or 10 years, and that's in the process of being reformed and reactivated.
Okay. I'd imagine that there will be some communication then between the two.
Yes.
I would think, naturally, people. And it's kind of hard because things all happened at once last year. And I remember we were sorting out red tide is this, blue-green algae is this. It was very hard to not get the two confused and one blaming one for the other and things like that. I wanted to ask, though, because we have another new confusing thing going on. Can you tell me the difference between the blue-green algae that we all suffered with last summer and then the other kinds of blue-green algae, and it's being called that in news reports, that have been reported around Captiva and in Sarasota recently? And they look like the brown mat kind of stuff.
Right. So in both cases, what we experienced last year, especially in Cape Coral canals, and what Captiva and Sarasota are experiencing are cyanobacteria. They are blue-green algae, but they're different kinds, different species. So in Cape Coral, we have a species that likes to float in the water, and it'll come right up to the surface and form these mats. It's called Microcystis. And then in Captiva and Sarasota, we have a different algal species that's a benthic species, And it basically forms more – instead of mats, it'll form tufts and you know, basically bundles of these filaments that will then wash up on the beach when they lift off the bottom.
And they look like that brown foamy
yeah.
crab. And it's stinky too, right?
Yeah, they can be stinky. And it might have a I haven't been on the beach or you know, on Bayside to experience the aroma myself.
But, the aroma.
You know, some of that could be just the degrading biomass. But when you look at the difference in color, a lot of it's due because they'll have different ratios and different compositions of pigments. And the easiest way to think of that is when you look at a leaf, like an oak leaf that changes color in the fall. You'll see the yellows, the oranges, and the reds come out. So those are different pigments besides the green chlorophyll that the tree leaves have in them. So these cyanobacteria will have other pigments besides mm-hmm. the green chlorophyll. Sometimes it makes them a little green looking. Sometimes it makes them brown looking. With red tide, they also have chlorophyll and different pigments. Sometimes they'll have a red color. So that's the other pigments that we're seeing in those cases.
It's really easy to misdiagnose unless you know what you're looking at, and unless you're looking at it through a microscope, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I get a lot of pictures of some discoloration on the water, some biomass that's collecting on the surface. What is this? And I can't tell from a cell phone picture. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't really want to say anything until I put it under a microscope so I can actually get a good identification on it.
Actually, yes, it's interesting. You have to kind of know what you're doing. But there are a lot of people who want to say out loud that they know what they're doing when they kind of don't. Look at this blue-green algae on my Facebook page that I'm sharing with everybody.
But they're concerned and they're aware, you know, mm-hmm. so they're starting to notice things in the water and a lot of that awareness is really good, really useful, and important to get the public engaged. But on the other hand, they may be getting a little jumpy on it because it is a big concern.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of have to take a measured approach to these sightings or these observations to make sure that it's a good leveled response.
How much do you think the task force is going to be working on the long-term projects? I know that we have a lot of long-term projects that are coming or on the way or in progress, which is moving water south of the lake so that it doesn't have to be put out through the rivers.
Right.
Is that a concern of the task force at this point, or that's kind of taken care of? Are you more immediately focused on what to do in the rivers, for example, in a month from now? Or?
Well, I think short term we have to focus a little bit more locally. But when we look longer term and, you know, some of these – when I talk longer term, we could even be addressing projects that are starting right now that won't be completed for several years. But if we look even, you know, 5-10 years down the road, I think the task force should look at some of the plans that are in place in terms of can we make further improvements? Are there – do we need to store more water? Do we need how can we more quickly move water south? Do we have the best plan in place? If you look at SERP now, it's 20 years old. So was that plan as developed and basically it was a compromise as well 20 years ago.
That was before
ago.
We all had smartphones.
Yeah.
Right? And could take pictures. Think about it. Things have changed a lot in 20 years, and I imagine in science quite a bit too.
And I think it would be a healthy discussion among the task force members at least to see if that is the best strategy moving forward or if we can improve that. I think everything should be on the table on how we can most efficiently and most quickly reduce nutrients and move water south. I mean, that's what we really need to do.
So I want to take a look at where we're at now. We get a weekly email from the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation here at the station. And listeners, you can sign up and get these reports too. We have a link on our website at gulfcoastlive.org if you'd like to receive these emails. So this week it reads, Caloosahatchee Condition Summary. Cyanobacteria is present along the river and estuary. Thick mats of Dapis pleosa, a benthic filamentous cyanobacteria, have been floating to the surface on Pine Island Sound and accumulating along the shore in some areas. Water clarity, though, around Sanibel and Captiva is excellent. That's an example of a weekly report that we get from the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation, which is one of the nonprofits who we heard a lot about last year when it came to monitoring and testing area waterways. Another is the Calusa Waterkeeper, and we're joined on the phone now by John Cassani, who's been out testing water along the Caloosahatchee. John, what are you seeing out there?
Hi, Julie, Mike. We're getting some reports of the cyanobacteria of the microcystin kind in North Fort Myers and We're seeing sporadic blooms as far upriver as La Belle, particularly in some of the oxbows. So it's out there. It seems to be a little earlier this year. Water temperatures are increasing, so not surprising that we're seeing some bloom formation take place.
Would you think that we would see those blooms whether we ever had anything coming from Lake O or not? Or can these things just pop up out there? Do you see them pop up out there without any releases from the lake?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I get asked that a lot. And again, Mike could maybe address these a little bit more in terms of the key triggers that initiate these blooms. So sometimes it's not just nitrogen and phosphorus. Sometimes it's a micronutrient like iron that triggers the bloom. Or something as physical as water temperature that would do it. So a lot of factors that contribute to the formation of a bloom. Certainly the lake discharges don't help the situation, and in years past we've seen the blooms start in the lake, and then when discharges happen, then we sometimes see blooms forming downriver in the Coosahatchee. So not necessarily cause and effect, but kind of looks that way to some degree, at least as a contributing factor from lake releases.
They do tend to kind of run parallel. When asked about our current situation, Congressman Francis Rooney and Governor Ron DeSantis last week pointed to lower lake levels right now before rainy season, saying that it could possibly lead to less of a need to dredge and potentially compromise the Herbert Hoover Dyke. What do you think as we stand on the precipice of the hot and rainy season with blue-green algae already there, but at least the lake levels are lower than where we were last year?
Yeah, my outlook is kind of like, well, how bad is the bloom on the lake? What's the cell density? If there's a lot of water moving out of the lake into the river, then that's an issue of moving the algal biomass around. I kind of like the idea of keeping the lake a little lower, which gives it more freeboard for storage. Hopefully that will translate into less of the sustained high-volume releases that typically occur during the summer. And the other thing that's driving some of this is climate change. There's so much unpredictability with hydrology now from storm events that it's hard to predict what the outcome will be, you know, a month down the road. So having that extra foot of storage in the lake, I think, is a really good thing at this point.
That is definitely helpful. John, I really want to thank you for all that you do out there monitoring the water, and thanks for joining the show today and talking with us.
Hey, glad to. Thanks, Julie.
That was John Cassani with the Colusa Waterkeeper. Dr. Mike Parsons, do you follow these reports as well, like from the Sanibel Captiva Conservation Foundation and the data that's collected by some of these nonprofits?
Yes. Yeah, I get reports from them.
Do you? What do you think about the outlook for this summer based on kind of where we're at now with a bit of blue-green algae already sort of showing up?
I think it's a little bit early to really know. But as John mentioned, you know, we are seeing microcystis out there in various locations. The water temperatures are increasing. People have made observations that it's a little early this year for seeing the microcystis in the river. We're not having – the lake levels are lower. We're not having the releases, you know, like we did. We don't have that inoculum coming down from the river and into the Coosahatchee and potentially into Cape Coral. So I think there are some signs that would indicate that, you know, we see the preconditions for a bloom, but we don't have all the signs.
We also don't know exactly how much rain we're going to get, how much the rivers, the lake's going to rise, and how much is going to have to be released.
And when you look at these blooms, when something blooms, it basically outcompetes everything else. So it just can manage the environmental conditions, grow faster, use up more of the resources versus any of the other algae, microalgae that are in the water. So are those conditions the same this year as last year? Not quite, but there are some similarities.
Hmm. So I mentioned that these are two non-governmental groups doing their part to monitor the watershed. Do you anticipate this task force working with groups like these in getting data points and filling out some research?
I think so. We've had meetings locally with different stakeholders and different resource managers, anything from City of Cape Coral to Fort Myers, Lee County, local DEP personnel, so on and so forth. And one thing that we all realized was everybody's sampling somewhere. Mm-hmm. But they all have their own rules and regulations, schedules on collecting samples, schedules of reporting, so on and so forth. So I think it'd be good to come up with a sampling regime where we can basically leverage each other's resources and make sure that we're basically collecting and reporting data the same way.
Yeah, so standard operating procedure, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's not apples and oranges. Everybody's counting the apples.
Yeah, because I know that you scientists are pretty specific about stuff.
We can get very specific.
Yeah. I mean, get hair splitting on analysis. And I get it because you want to make sure you're right.
And use big words and things like that.
And they also like to prove each other wrong too. So you want to make sure your data is
you know, it's just making sure the data are collected properly and interpreted properly. So
that way the collaboration can be a lot easier and actually more fruitful, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
More efficient and more fruitful.
If you're just joining the show, I'm talking with Dr. Mike Parsons. He is professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University and director of the university's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station. And he was recently named by Governor Ron DeSantis to the new Blue-Green Algae Task Force. If you'd like to ask him a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCO. So, Dr. Parsons, I feel like it would be important to point out that not all blue-green algae comes from the lake, even though it's one of the sources, especially after Hurricane Irma churned everything up. How does algae even get into our freshwater to begin with?
So basically, when you look at let's just say it's a closed body of water, so a closed circuit system, you generally have some population. It might be a very rare, low number of cells that are present, always present in the water. And then again, as the conditions dictate, maybe they'll become competitive and they'll reach a bloom population because they can outcompete other species. But these algae can basically jump, quote unquote, from one pond to another or one lake to another. There's different ways where we've seen transport happening by, for example, big wind events and blowing the spray off of a water body into another water body.
Does it evaporate into rain and travel that way ever?
It won't necessarily evaporate. It'll be more encapsulated in the water droplets and then carried by the wind. There have been some studies looking at birds. So you might have a duck land in one water body and then go and land in another one. And so people, boats, you know, there's evidence that boats and your trailers, you might have some algal scum on your trailer when you pick up your boat at the boat ramp and then you go and launch your boat at another site, inoculating that water body. So there's a lot of different mechanisms. When you're looking at something that's all plumbed together, like Lake Okeechobee into the Caloosahatchee, into Cape Coral canals, you can see the conduit. It's a continuous system, but then, you know, we don't fully understand how everything's connected. And in particular, with last year's bloom, was the bloom in Cape Coral from Lake Okeechobee? And I've been asked that question. I've talked to various people about it. Some people say yes. And it's like, well, where's the evidence? And then you talk to other people, can we even prove it? And it's like, well, we don't have any, you know, genetic fingerprinting proof of that. But if you look at just the way the waters have been moving and things like that, it would make sense. So again, when we start
anecdotally,
it gets a little squishy, you know, we don't have firm evidence, but
there's no algae forensic, is there?
There are – you can use algae in forensics, but we don't have the
means on the actual algae itself.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. So is this task force going to be looking at ways to minimize blue-green algae's presence in area waters, ways to remove it once it gets there, or how the public should respond or safeguard themselves when the inevitability of another bloom occurs?
I think a general word we could use is mitigate the impacts.
Uh-huh.
And so some of that may be removing the biomass. Some of it may be killing the algae.
Is there anything that kills algae besides bleach, which is not a good idea?
There are a lot of different ways you can kill the algae. There are various chemical means you can do it. There are some biological means where you can actually introduce a bacteria that then outcompetes with the cyanobacteria for the nutrients. So you can starve the bloom.
I'm just concerned now about invasive species because we always hear about that, an invasive bacteria or something. Are
exactly.
there side effects?
Yeah. So I think one thing the task force will at least provide some guidance for would be, here are some various technologies or various tools that can be used to reduce the biomass of the cyanobacteria, what are the pros and cons of each?
This has to be kind of exciting for you because you're going to get to just really dig your teeth into all the data that's already been collected and all the studies that have already been done and try to aggregate this into a purposeful movement forward.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that part. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, appointed by the governor and part of the DEP working with Tom Frazier, the new chief science officer, and Noah Valenstein, secretary of DEP, a lot of people are going to be watching, you know. And so there's no pressure at all. And, you know, they want results. The public wants results. You know, the last thing they need to hear is like, well, we need to study it more and da-da-da-da.
No, I know.
It's like, what are some action items? What are some what's real progress? What are real steps we can take to address this immediately? And I think that's what they want. And I think that's what we should really be looking at, you know, that we should really be trying to address that the best way possible. Now, we do not know everything, so there will be questions that we're going to have to get answers to come. But
it surprises me that something like this hasn't happened before, because this isn't the only place that there has been blue-green algae blooms. I mean, Ohio, they have a lot of problems with this as well. Yeah. And even around the world, I've heard over in Asia there are some yes. areas that are hot spots for this. But nobody's really come together with this kind of a very purposeful, we are going to try to find the solutions as best as we can.
Well, I think what you're looking at is a lot of regions have tackled the problem from a regional or isolated sense.
Yeah, our weather situation is different from Ohio,
yeah,
for example.
And so – you know, I think there does need to be a better technology and intellectual exchange in terms of, what did you learn? Can that be applied here? It may not all work. You know, for example, with the Macondo oil spill, our best data set on oil was the Exxon Valdez. You know, and so Prince Edward Island, in Alaska, where you're basically dealing with a subarctic environment versus a subtropical environment, oil did not react the same way. And so we couldn't necessarily take our lessons learned there. So when you look at China, let's say, or when you look at Lake Erie, how much of that will be applicable to down here in our subtropical environment? And that's something I think we need to look at too.
One of the things that we just talked about a little bit about is the intense amount of pressure that is going to be that we want solutions, right?
Right.
But that's not something that is that you're a stranger to, because you've been on this show a number of times talking about red tide, blue green, everything. Science is looking for answers to questions that really have the public on edge.
Right.
For example, there's talk about toxins from this algae, or one in particular, BMAA, causing diseases like Parkinson's, ALS, and Alzheimer's. And these kinds of reports really make people anxious, understandably. But it's hard to know what to believe as proven and what's still being studied. I mean, do we really know how these toxins affect people?
We do not. There is evidence of effects, but it's not conclusive. There are studies that conflict. And in the case of microcystin, especially microcystin LR, which is one of the toxins produced by microcystis and some other cyanobacteria, that's a liver toxin, liver and kidney toxin. We know more about that, but we have World Health Organization has guidelines in terms of what levels people should be wary of and should avoid water, so on and so forth, getting in the water and drinking water, for example. But for aerosols in the air, there are no such guidelines. And so with BMAA, there's still a lot of debate on, is it actually a toxin? And you can get people that are 100% sure it is, and you can get people that are not 100% sure. And mm-hmm. so you can argue about it all day. But we can't even agree on that, much less determine what the guidelines should be and the numerical standards should be for human health risk. And so
– risk and exposure, right?
Yeah. And so you know, in that case, there is a lot of work that needs to be done, because we really need to know what threat both toxins, or both compounds, I should say, represent, and then what is the risk of exposure and what is the risk assessment there? What can we safely be exposed to? In terms of microcystins, we need to go down that road. In terms of BMAA, we need to really establish with certainty and have consensus that, you know, it is a toxin that we need to set guidelines for.
I mean, at this point, it's more of a personal risk-benefit analysis for individuals because as it stands, the science and data isn't really there for an official pronouncement to be made.
Right.
So yeah. We're not at the point where we have the science for the Department of Health to come and say this is a cause for concern. They don't have that evidence really to come out and say it.
No, definitely not. And, you know, it's basically a life choice almost. It's, you know, what you eat. Should you eat this?
Well, some people eat organic. Some people don't.
Yeah. You know, some people smoke. Some people don't. Some people drink. Some people don't. So right now I think that's the best way that we can deal with this and you just have to kind of ask yourself if it is a risk, are you willing to expose yourself to it?
It's an interesting position that scientists are all in too now where you have to measure your words more carefully than I would imagine you thought when you first went into this field. You have to be careful what you say because people can grab a nugget and really run.
Yeah, especially when you know when we're dealing with human health and then we're also dealing with the economic impacts and the environmental impacts. So what you say can reverberate through your local network of people and whoever else is either listening to the radio or through social media these days in particular.
That's quite the megaphone.
Yeah.
And it gets really – so I'm going to ask one last question before I cut you loose. Dale in Cape Coral, he would like for you to look into your crystal ball of science, which I know scientists are big fans of, and guess how long it might take to actually solve this problem if it is solvable.
I think it's really two questions. Number one, how quickly can we move water south?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe tied in with that nutrient reduction because we need to reduce nutrients as well to move the water south effectively. Once we figure that out, the problem should go away, honestly. There is going to be some legacy nutrients that have to work their way through the system. But in terms of short term, I think we have to go canal by canal, pond by pond with some of these remediation technologies that various companies and individuals are proposing.
What did you think of that? There was that one that was used in the BP oil spill that attracted the blue-green algae to it. It looked like foam noodles.
Yeah.
Did you see that one? That one looks interesting.
Yeah.
Yet to be seen. The task force has to look at that one too, among other things.
And I'm not sure what role. I think that's something we have to discuss together. What role are we going to play in – are we going to just help set criteria on how these different technologies are vetted? Are we going to propose a vetting process? Are we going to, you know, suggest that the vetting process is funded? I have no idea. You know, we need to address it. And DEP does have a vetting process in place. It was put in place last year, mm-hmm. and we'll just see how that's going to renew for this year if we need it. We should probably be proactive and have it set up in any case.
And I guess once you have that science, you can present that to lawmakers next legislative session and say, this is what we found. This is the most effective removal mechanism or whatever. And then they can then figure out deployment.
And it may not be a one size fits all.
Yeah.
You know, so these technologies might work best in this situation. These may be better in this situation.
Just like Alaska versus Cape Coral.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's all the time we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. Mike Parsons, a professor of marine science at Florida Gulf Coast University. He's also director of the university's Coastal Watershed Institute and Vester Field Station and was recently named by Governor Ron DeSantis to the new Blue-Green Algae Task Force. Dr. Parsons, thanks always for your time.
Sure, no problem.
When we return, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission is kicking off its fifth annual Lionfish Challenge this weekend. We'll learn more about this ongoing effort to control the invasive species through incentives for anglers and divers. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.